The Truth About Mars by Ernest L. Norman. Preface. A few months ago, the astronomical and astrophysical world was tremendously excited by the approaching conjunction of the Earth with the planet Mars. This article, being written in May 1955, refers to the conjunction of Mars with the Earth at the turn of the year 1954 to 1955. Many prominent astronomical authorities hoped to settle once and for all time the old controversial issues about this planet, i.e., were there canals or were there not canals on Mars, and was this planet inhabited by some form of man? So far as can be ascertained, the results of these investigations, after thousands of photographs of the planet and numerous controversies, was that some groups were even more firmly entrenched in their original ideas, while others became more confused than ever. In an overall sense, it can be said that they arrived at no definite conclusion whatever, nor will any new conclusions that may be arrived at have, by the same token, any more validity than the original concepts. Therefore, any new attempt at visualizing life or the canals on Mars resolves into the realm of clairvoyance and not by the making of bigger and more powerful telescopes. The 200-inch telescope at MT Palomar has, in a sense, merely increased the size of the universe for man rather than brought it closer to him. Now, just in case the term clairvoyant should arouse any antagonism or question in some persons, let us digress a moment to explain just what is meant by the word clairvoyance. Clairvoyance, or the development of the sixth sense, is only another word for extrasensory perception taking place within the consciousness of man rather than through the reactionary physical senses such as physical sight, hearing, smell, touch, and taste. Practically everyone on this earth has had or will, at some time, be in a semi or momentarily clairvoyant state. Anyone having a so-called hunch or premonition is momentarily in such a state. At the Great Duke University, Dr. Rhine, in his 50 years of research on parapsychology, has definitely established the facts and truths of extrasensory perception. There are numerous societies, associations, and organizations, national and international, whose many years of work have proven beyond a doubt that man does have, and can also develop, this extrasense or clairvoyance, sometimes called the sixth sense. Any doubting Thomas can, if he is open-minded enough, find in a short time an overwhelming mass of evidence to support this truth. In an advanced state of clairvoyance, an individual sees and lives in a state of consciousness which tunes him in, as it were, to past or future events, places, and happenings, distance being no barrier. Such an awareness or consciousness is almost as real as the everyday objects around him. Any particular electrical or mechanical device, such as the television set, will demonstrate to some extent the nature of this conception. A savage in the jungle would immediately be confounded were he presented with the appearance of some of our everyday appliances. He would quite likely, in his failure to understand or conceive, throw up his hands and deny the whole thing. He would, in a sense, be like the farmer who saw the giraffe for the first time, exclaiming that there is no such animal. It is, as it has always been, the great lack of ability to form new concepts which has always caused man to throw up his hands and cry out loudly against the appearance of any new thought, or mechanical or electrical contrivance. This is also quite true of most of our modern-day scientists, whether he is a man of medicine, of chemistry, or of astronomy. Therefore, it is up to individuals who have developed this extrasense or clairvoyance to fill in the obvious gaps in our many branches of science as well as in some of the more firmly established spiritual concepts. In writing an article of this kind, no effort is being made to prove what I have found and believe is true. Truth is entirely independent of the individual. After my 35 years of active research in the fields of electronics, physics, astrophysics, parapsychology, and their allied and associated sciences, I have succeeded in correlating and establishing an integrated concept, which when combined with a natural and highly developed clairvoyance gives, to a practically perfect degree, a direct mental contact not only with person to person upon this earth, but in contacting individuals living on other planets. This is in a sense, what can be called conscious astral flight, inasmuch as I see the cities and the people and hear the individuals, as they now exist on other planets. No mechanical devices are used, nor is any particularly advanced degree of trance state entered into, maintaining conscious continuity and being able to quote at the time, just what is taking place both audibly and visibly, at all times. Chapter 1 Contact with Planet Mars. Since the dawn of time and the beginning of man's history on this planet, the starry skies have always been something of not only great and wondrous beauty, but also filled with mystery and awe. The histories of the ancient times contain numerous references to the sun, the moon, and the many bright stars and planets. Man has worshipped these heavenly bodies as deities or gods. Quite often the very nature of the religious beliefs of the peoples were woven around these mystical heavenly orbs. Naturally, there has been a great deal of conjecture as to life and the existence of man in some form on some of these bright specks of light. This is especially true of the moon and of the planets of our solar system. Men like Copernicus, Galileo, Plato, etc., all speculated on this possibility. During the last 25 years or so, there has been a tremendous impetus given to astronomical interests. Perhaps this is partly due to the approach of the conclusion of a great cycle and the actual beginning of the Aquarian Age. There are numerous monthly publications which deal in a fictional way with interplanetary travel and life on other planets. There likewise are other articles and stories which have appeared from time to time dealing with flying saucers and spaceships, etc., which claim to be true, and as a small lad I shared this common interest in the heavens. Often I would peer through my father's telescope, which was of very modest power, at the moon or other bright points of interest. Winter nights would often be devoted to poring over any book or article containing anything of an astronomical nature. It was not, however, until the close of World War II and the sudden influx of flying saucer stories that time and circumstances permitted resuming this fascinating subject. Along with metaphysical work which I did both in churches and independently, the planets, space travel, etc., all became an integrated part of this work. It was inevitable that sooner or later I should actually take a flight to some planet, not that this would be done in a rocket or some such machine, man has not progressed to such an advanced state of engineering as yet. So any such trips would be in a clairvoyant state. I am not the only one by far, who has had such experiences. The persons both known and unknown who have made such flights and contacts are too numerous to mention at this time. I might add that much of what is written in the following pages has since been corroborated by some of these persons, without my previously having read any articles so written by them. It has been my consistent habit to spend an hour or so of the late evening time in meditation. During these hours I have made innumerable contacts with those who have passed from this plane of existence. However, no serious attempt at interplanetary contact was tried until the second month of the year of 1955. At that time I began to be increasingly aware that something like this was being attempted by the peoples of other planets. One evening, about the first part of May, of this year, while in a deep meditative state, I suddenly perceived a rather strange-looking man standing before me. At first I thought him to be Chinese, as his dress and general appearance was somewhat similar to that of a man of ancient China. After introducing himself as Nur-El, however, he quickly explained he was from the planet Mars, and that if I so desired, I could go there with him, to his city, in astral flight, and that he would be my personal guide. He explained that his people were very desirous, in view of all the controversy going on, to clear up some of the so-called mysteries of Mars. He further assured me that it was quite obvious that a complete understanding was not possible in one visitation, therefore as the first contact was made, it would be comparatively easy to establish other contacts, as was convenient and necessary. Since this first contact and trip was made, I have returned on several occasions. In fact, Nur-El often stood beside me as I wrote, to further clear up, or refresh my memory regarding any details which were not entirely clear. Now I will contact my Martian guide and take an astral flight through space, and see just how it is that man lives on the red planet. Almost immediately a very distinguished-looking man stands before me. He is Nur-El, a man of high position and esteem from one of the Martian cities. He is dressed in a very brilliant red suit. The coat is long, almost to the knees, with loose-fitting pantaloons. On his head is a red hat with a square-shaped brim that is turned up on four sides. Our trip there is a matter of split seconds as no craft is used or needed. Arriving on the surface of Mars, we are at once aware of the extremely rugged terrain, rocky hills, and sandy wastes, that stretches out endlessly around us. There are many peculiar whirling dust clouds all about. Nur-El explains that the ionosphere is very thin, which leaves the surface almost unprotected from the various beta, gamma, and cosmic rays. This high concentration of rays ionizes the very rare and gaseous atmosphere and, together with the thermal currents, creates terrific dust storms. There is also a very thinly divided dust layer on the ionosphere which helps create the reddish appearance of the planet. There are also a number of volcanoes, three of which are of major size. One of these was just barely visible on the horizon, trailing a thin wisp of smoke from its truncated cone. It was also explained that as Mars has only 7 degrees axis inclination, there is not much of a seasonal change. Water is very scarce on this arid planet, most of the precipitation falls at the poles. Vegetation is also scarce. There are a few varieties of prickly cacti-looking plants. Also near the polar ice caps, grows a very luxuriant green alga-like plant that follows the melting snow line. This spongy growth often attains a height, or depth, of 40 to 50 feet. It appears and disappears with the season as it grows tremendously rapidly, and it also disintegrates very fast. There are also a number of species of lizards, reptiles, and of some insects whose hard shells have enabled them to weather the extreme atmospheric conditions, and among them are giant ants which walk semi-erect on the two hind feet. The guide tells me these are mutants which were accidentally produced from a small ant in an atomic experiment ages ago. They are similar to humans in a very low state of intelligence, and at one time it became necessary to make war on them, as they became so numerous and large. These strange ant creatures average 2 to 4 feet in height and live in rocky caves. But we did not tarry long on the surface. I followed my guide to a rather strange-looking rock. Then, taking a small whistle from his coat pocket, he blew one note, and although I heard nothing, the rock immediately swung open, disclosing a car-like elevator. We entered and, after the door closed, I had the familiar dropping sensation of our own modern elevators. The trip down took but a few seconds, and, upon stopping, I stepped forth into what was my first glimpse of a Martian city. I was immediately impressed by the soft white light that seemed to come from everywhere. We were standing near the entrance of a large tube. On Mars, the cities are all underground and are connected together by huge oval metal tubes from 300 to 500 feet in diameter. There are monorail cars as long as our Pullman trains, which glide silently and very swiftly from one city to another. The bottoms of these immense tubes are used for parks, growing foodstuffs, and innumerable small manufacturing plants. Because of the great distances between the cities, these tubes have been built only partially submerged. There are emergency airlocks and bulkheads at the ends where they connect to the domes. Other safety and precautionary measures are used to protect the cities and tunnels in case of breakdowns or outside attack. It is these tubes which have confused the astronomers on the Earth. Some believe them to be canals. There are also other theories. The shifting desert sands often cover or uncover them, which leads to further confusion inasmuch as they seem to appear and disappear. Turning about and looking down into the city is an unforgettable experience. Like all cities on Mars, it is built on the floor of a huge metal dome. These domes are sometimes 4 or 5 miles in diameter, and up to 3,000 feet high. They are constructed of huge curved trusses of a whitish metal, seemingly of a magnesium compound. These trusses are covered with a metal top and bottom, and the space in between filled with a plastic foam similar to the construction of the houses. This also gives added protection from the various cosmic rays, as well as sealing in the precious air supply. Underneath the roof is an inner shell or a second false shell, which is composed of sheets of pale blue plastic. This is suspended from brackets from the dome at a distance of about 6 feet. In this space are the many thousands of fluorescent tubes which make up the lighting system, and they reflect downward the soft radiant light which I first noticed. I was told this light is very similar to a modified sunlight, and is very healthful and stimulating to plant life, as well as to the people. As these domes are built in the bottom of excavations, the sands soon drift over them and cover them up, giving added protection from the strong surface rays. Chapter 2, Underground Cities of Mars. The Martian cities are laid out like a wheel. The center hub is a very large circular structure which houses the various municipal and civic governmental departments. Underground is a very large atomic power plant for supplying the city's needs. The streets stretch away from the hub like spokes, and at regular intervals circular streets are intersected. This is similar to our national capital. The streets which radiate from the hub rise at a very gentle rate of inclination. The houses and other buildings are built on low elevations which rise like tiers. Walking up one of these streets gives one the impression of walking on air, as the paving is of a springy plastic material in a very soft shade of green. Stopping to inspect some of the houses, I am nearly overwhelmed by their wondrous beauty, simplicity, and charm. In every small, vacant space in the streets and grounds around the houses are growing plants. These are mostly fruits and vegetables. They are planted in metal troughs and other containers. The soil is a mixture of natural and artificial plant humus and moss. The houses and buildings are semi-prefabricated in a wide variety of plastic and pastel shades. The walls are formed of two sheets of thin plastic about 2 inches apart. After the walls are fastened together, a liquid foam-like plastic material is injected or blown in between the walls. After this hardens, it gives the whole structure tremendous strength. This hardened plastic foam acts also as a good insulator. There is no problem of heat or cold in a Martian city, with an abundance of atomic power. The whole city is air-conditioned, free from dust and fumes, and is maintained at a constant temperature of about 68 degrees. Further comfort is assured the occupants of each home by its own air conditioner. Huge electronic pumps suck in and filter the thin outside air and raise the pressure to about 7 pounds per square inch. This is somewhat of the same way in which a modern Earth airliner pressurizes the passenger cabins. It also strengthens the overhead dome structure by pushing out uniformly at all points simultaneously. As the outside atmosphere is very rare and of a low oxygen content, the Martian cities are becoming less and less dependent on that source of air supply. Many thousands of years ago they learned how to obtain air from water by electrolysis. They also make a great effort to create great underground reservoirs near the ice caps to drain off and store any surplus surface water which also, along with the oxygen, has become increasingly rare through the centuries. At the present time, scientists on Mars are learning to make air and water synthetically out of other elements. They have also explored every possible existing subterranean river or lake and have added much to the dwindling water supply by some important discoveries. It is estimated that, with careful conservation, they will have enough water for several thousand years, during which time other means will have been arrived at for solving this problem. Mars is very rich in mineral deposits, of which some of the radioactive variety are especially abundant. The planet has also, like the Earth, a molten liquid core of some of the more dense elements. Scientists on Mars are tapping these deep fiery realms as an extra or added power supply, although the abundant radioactive elements are at present more than adequate to supply all the needs. All buildings are supplied with electric power from the central power plant. The power is radiated over ultra-high frequency beams which crisscross the streets, and are relayed by smaller substations. On top of each building is a split ball-like antenna which intercepts these power beams, bringing power down onto a small secondary radiator which in turn radiates the power through the building, lighting the lights, operating the various motors, etc. These are, of course, all constructed very differently than the motors and electric lights on Earth, which are large, clumsy, and very inefficient by comparison. Window glass is a polarized material which transmits light one way, from outside in, which gives privacy without the problem of shade and drapes. A simple metal folding shutter is sometimes drawn across the window to shut out the light when sleeping, etc. Furniture in the home is very simple and is contoured to the body and is made of metal and plastic. The houses are not overly furnished as are so many of Earth homes, yet there is sufficient for comfort in a simple fashion. Rugs are a plastic foam-like material which is springy and resilient with no dusty nap. Various colors are used and slightly raised designs which give variety and charm to the lovely overall appearance. The kitchens would be a delight to the Earth woman, all cooking is done in an oven which is built in a wall cabinet. The oven is operated on high frequencies which cook all foods in a matter of a very few minutes, or, in most cases only a few seconds. There is a dial-like indicator which is preset. The food to be cooked is placed in the oven, the door closed, a red light flashes, after a few seconds is turned off, and presto, the meal is cooked. I did not see any boiling or frying, in the conventional way. After dinner, the dishwashing is a very quick and simple process. The dishes are placed in a metal cabinet, a dial set, and after a few minutes all are clean and sparkling, no water is used. Instead, streams of electronic energy of some sort does the job. The dishes are made of a plastic-like material which is repellent to soil. The bathroom is also quite different. The stool appears or disappears in the wall as needed. Disposal is efficiently taken care of by electrolysis. Very little water apparently is used. Bathing is done in a small booth where an atomized spray of pleasant-smelling liquid is sprayed on the body and wiped off with a very absorbent towel. Here also, no water is used. There is also some kind of energy ray used which stimulates and leaves the body very refreshed. Teeth are cleaned with a sort of electronic brush which is a metal rod on a handle. Moving it around the teeth directs a flow of energy which cleans and stimulates the teeth and gums. Very little of the normally expected house cleaning is done in a Martian home, all interior surfaces are dirt repellent and, as the air is normally very clean and inasmuch as there is no smoking, frying or similar soot producers, the homes are very clean and spotless. Mounting a flight of stairs to the roof, we emerge onto a typical Martian garden. The roofs of these homes are flat and planted with a wide variety of fruits, vegetables, and flowers. Each home grows quite a lot of the normal supply of foodstuff it consumes. They take great pride in these roof gardens and frequently engage in friendly competition in contests between neighbors in an attempt to raise the most beautiful displays of horticulture. Returning to the street after my first glimpse into a Martian home, I became aware that there was something missing which was customarily found in a city. Glancing up and down the street, it suddenly occurred to me. There were no stores, no shops, no neon signs or any of the familiar garishness one finds in our cities. My bewilderment caused Nur El to smile. Motioning me to follow, he walked over to where a low, circular platform stood, up a few inches from the street level. We stepped on this platform and almost immediately began a slow descent through a metal tube. On coming to rest, a door opened and we stepped out into what was another great surprise. Now I understood why the streets slanted up and the lack of stores and commercial buildings, for here stretched out before me was a huge shopping center, which in some odd way reminded me of one of our annual state fairs. Up and down and around were streets and aisles with shops and booths displaying the many articles of clothing and food familiar to the Martian way of life. There was, however, noticeable differences. Little or no advertising was used, the shop owner sat or stood quietly by or worked on various articles he, or she, sold. A quaint system of barter and exchange is generally prevalent, although some form of script, currency similar to a department store charge plate, is also used. Martians are inherently honest, stealing is almost unknown. Consequently, there is no need to accumulate more than is needed, for they do not have the fear of insecurity. There is no price haggling over various transactions. Some sections have mechanical automat-like dispensers in which a keyed charge plate is inserted and withdrawn after the article is discharged. Another curious feature of these marketplaces are the escalator sidewalks. On several of the main thoroughfares were double tracks, one coming and one going, with a small bench-like seat to sit on. A person merely stepped on, sat down and was moved slowly up and down in front of the various stalls or shops. Everywhere I turned to look I saw happy, smiling faces with none of that taut, drawn look that is so prevalent in our cities. I was informed that there are several of these centers, which are regularly interspersed around the circumference of the cities and located in the space formed by the floor of the dome and the rural sections above. In between these market centers, much space is devoted to the cultivation of various crops, one of which is a grain very similar to millet. There is also a species of rice which grows with very little moisture. It seems that many of these plant crops have been evolved through a Burbank-like process to a point where they require the absolute minimum of water. No heavy manufacturing is done in these cities, but there are several domes which are devoted to, and used almost exclusively for, this type of work. But time was slipping by, and reluctantly I followed my guide to another elevator and we ascended back to the main level. As we walked along one of the streets, I could not help but feel overawed by the beauty of all the things around me, the lovely homes and roof gardens, the landscaped parkways growing lush with fruits and flowers, the peace and quiet which was everywhere. I looked curiously at some of those who were passing by, although I do not believe they could see me in my astral state. At least if they did so, they gave no indication that they were being rudely stared at, and I assumed their smiles and greetings were meant for Nur-El. I did not see any indication of the use of any cosmetics on the women's faces. Their eyes were quite large and black with a distinct slant, the skin was wax-like and beautifully colored, lips red and well-shaped, which in all left nothing to be desired in any external adornment. There are other things which were noticeable by their absence. There is no smoking, the use of tobacco being unheard of. Nur-El chuckled when I asked about this, stating that such a practice was grown-up thumb-sucking and was a habit belonging only to those who were not completely weaned. The drinking of alcoholic beverages is also unknown, so there were none of the familiar taverns or liquor houses. No doubt many of the Earthenes would be lost on Mars without their familiar daily and hourly inhalations and libations of pap and belly wash. The people of Mars are smaller than those on Earth, only averaging about 4 feet 6 inches in height. They are somewhat Mongolian in appearance. The texture of the skin is very fine and soft, while the hair is usually straight, black, and quite fine. The men do not need to shave, for they have eradicated electronically the growth of hair from their faces when still young. The Martians are a quiet, peace-loving people. Their clothing is simple with long loose flowing lines, with nothing to bind them, in many brilliant colors including many shades we know not. All clothing is made of synthetic materials as no natural fibers are grown. Martians are much older in solo evolution than the Earthenes. They originally migrated in spacecraft to Mars from a dying planet more than a million years ago. They also came to this Earth and started a colony but found it impractical to maintain. It was also explained by Nur-El that this colony became our Chinese race through the evolution of time. Chapter 3, Martian Science and Technology. Talking as we walked along, we soon came to the end of the street where it joined the center hub. Before us was a very imposing structure which formed part of the circular center section. As we entered, I immediately became aware that it was some kind of laboratory. Various strange chemical odors were faintly discernible. We were met at the door by another Martian named Yuzak. He was dressed in a bright yellow cloak or smock with a large blue circle with a cross in the center, embroidered on the right side of the breast, which denoted his rank as a head scientist. After introductions, he took us in tow and we proceeded to make a tour of this great laboratory. The first section we entered was devoted to research, Yuzak explained. His science was very much advanced compared to that of Earth. On Mars, the scientists know how to create and grow life tissue as well as plant chlorophyll. This is done by an elaborate process which involves the use of certain kinds of life-creating radiations or energy streams. It was explained that energy was actually, in a sense, tapped from the fourth dimension and that in such a state it was constructive and intelligent and could create life in artificial tissue or plasma. Passing on into another section, which proved to be a clinic, we found a number of doctors and attendants busily engaged in various activities. These people were dressed in bright blue garb. We did not tarry long here, but as we passed through, Yuzak explained that while there is very little sickness, the same knowledge of radiant energy was also used here to treat various physical and mental disorders. A malfunctioning kidney could be restored in a matter of minutes, or if damaged, could be partially or completely regrown in a few hours. Cancer and many other so-called incurable diseases are removed or corrected in the same electronic way. It was also explained that in all cases, the patient was given a psychic diagnosis which correctly locates the true originating cause, as a psychic pressure or shock, incurred in either the present life or in some previous lifetime. Extended psychosomatics. Mental disorders, while rare, yield quickly to this treatment, which quickly removes or rectifies these malformed vortices, or thought wave patterns which have been incurred in the subconscious or psychic body. There are no jails or prisons. Crime is considered a mental disorder and treated thusly. Such treatment is kept secret and not exploited as we do, therefore there is no deflation of the ego. There is no pain or shock or lengthy doctoring. Usually the patient is home in a matter of hours. But here again we have come to another section. In the rear of this great building, upon entering, I am again impressed with the tremendous array of strange and unusual looking apparatus. I have visited laboratories but nothing like this. Going over to the side wall where there is a row of small glass tanks, something like aquariums, I noted that over and around each one is a tremendous array of tubes, pumps, cables, etc. Looking closely into the tank, I see a yellowish cloudy liquid with something in the center which looks like a baby. Recovering from my surprise and shock, I was assured by Yuzak that it was a baby. He went on to say that their science had advanced to such a point that this laboratory development was possible under conditions similar to those of natural growth in the womb of the mother. There is first grown a capillaric system from two main tubes spaced about a foot apart, a web of tiny tubes form. These in turn unite in the center and form a structure similar to that found in the body. This structure is grown in this aquarium-like tank in a plasmic-like liquid under radiant energies. After the capillaric web is formed, a membranous tissue grows over all. This is the artificial placenta. The ovum from the mother is then attached and inseminated with the father's spermatozoa. From then on, the fetus grows in a normal way, being attached to the placenta with the umbilical cord supplied with the natural blood supply, which actually, in part, comes from the mother. Under these controlled conditions, the natural incubation period may be reduced by one half. The blood supply is constantly refreshed and purified from a central blood bank or with such similar Rh factors. View of a portion of one of the Martian laboratories, which serve as an artificial gestation period to bring a baby into existence when natural birth is impossible. Nur-El further explained that this laboratory process was only taken advantage of by those women who could not ordinarily bear a child or where there were other and sufficient reasons for so doing. Passing through this laboratory, the guide went further into the problems of birth control and sex. He stated that children are limited to usually two to a family so as to prevent overcrowding and a lessening of an advanced family relationship. The ratio of births is usually determined by the death rate average. Sex relations are very sacred and considered a great creative gift. There are none of the usual sexual stimulants, such as advertising, spiced heavy foods, etc., which tend to overexcite the people of Earth. Consequently, sex assumes its rightful place in the life of the Martians. These people have a basic spiritual concept which teaches them from birth the importance of love of one another and finding their greatest joys of life in doing for each other, not doing each other. I did not see any of our familiar churches and steeples. It was explained to me that there are none. Worship is not a pagan-like bowing down to some mythical god, or gods, but a twice-daily observance to the great infinite creative source, and there is a once-weekly community observance giving thanks to this source. Other spiritual aspects of Martian life include communications with those who have passed into the spirit world. In fact, every Martian considers his spirit friends and relatives a part of his daily life. No doubt our Chinese have derived their ancestor worship from this source. The Martians have also developed reincarnation to a point where it forms an integral part of their lives. They plan for a future time when they will again relive a new life among old friends and relatives. Many children frequently identify themselves as former loved ones. I was tremendously impressed and overawed by all that I had just seen, when, passing out of the building, we entered the courtyard or foyer to the central section, which is a large community stage and theater. Sitting there to rest, my guide went on to further explain some of these fascinating facets of life in these cities. He was still talking of children, and said that soon after the birth of a child, all the potential mental faculties and quotients were determined by an electronic diagnosis, and any criminal or negative characteristics were removed by the radiant energy process. The child was further conditioned against such recurrence. There are no public schools. The child is taught to a large extent in his sleep by Azire, which imparts the lessons or knowledge directly into his subconscious mind. This ray can be likened somewhat to a radio frequency which carries the spoken word yet is inaudible to the ear. In this case, however, it is received and stored for use in the child's mind. Usually a child will have the equivalent to a college education by the time he has reached the age of 10. Such schooling is done to bring out the best points of character and to especially train him in whatever vocation he is best suited for. As I listened to the soft accented voice of my Martian friend, my mind inadvertently began to recall and compare scenes of my Earth life with the simple quiet way I was just beginning to glimpse and understand. Things like the roaring streets and highways, the stench and smell of thousands of cars, of hate and greed and avarice. Nur-El caught my thoughts and for a moment stopped speaking. A slow smile lifted the corners of his mouth and his eyes began to twinkle. "No," he said, "these people would not migrate to the Earth. First they would have to become accustomed to the difference in air pressure, and if this were done suddenly it might be very dangerous, like a diver going down beneath the water too quickly." He paused a moment then continued, "Then there would be deadly disease germs and the many viruses that we hear on Mars, not having had such things for thousands of years, have lost our resistance to." I could see his point, but I wondered a bit as to how they knew so much about the Earth. But patiently he explained that there were semi-surface observatories with electronic telescopes as well as a variety of radio and radar-like devices which gave them a very good idea of what went on there. Besides, some of the more advanced scientists were masters at astral flight. Even an ordinary citizen of Mars was quite adept at mental telepathy, and this type of communication was used as much as speech. But I was curious about the large theater which was confronting me, however. I waited until the explanation came that this was the large central theater or community playhouse. Here the various plays, pageants, and observances took place. There were also many civic orchestras, and various kinds of folk dances were given here. Many of these customs are of ancient origin and the meaning of some has almost been lost in antiquity. I was privileged to see part of a spring festival. Here on the great central stage several hundred children were gathered in large circles, all decorated profusely with flower garlands. In the center was the Queen of Spring. The children were all moving slowly to and fro and chanting a slow sing-song rhythm. It was all very beautiful and colorful. Going back into the ring-shaped building, we emerged into what were some of the chambers used for judging or administrative phases. The government is of a very simple form. I was amazed when told there are no written laws. Each citizen lives under a simple understanding of unwritten code. It was a very reasonable facsimile, if not the actual golden rule. In other words, do for others first. If a person acts selfishly, or begins to steal or shows symptoms of anger, he is considered ill and treatment is quickly administered. Each five families have a group leader or Ikla, as he is called. He represents this group and is responsible for their general welfare. The judges or heads of different departments are chosen on their merit, and it is usually done through elimination examinations which require a lifetime of special training. There are no political systems. Brains and character alone determine a candidate's fitness for an office. Male and female are regarded as equal and with no discrimination shown. There are no old age institutions in these Martian cities. Great respect is shown the aged, and they live with their children until the time of passing. No doubt the Chinese on the Earth brought this custom of respect and veneration down through the ages from their Martian ancestors. Passing along through a hallway, we again emerged into what I immediately gathered to be a library. Here a number of persons were busily engaged in sorting and caring for a large variety of books, if they can be compared to ours. These were for the most part rather ancient scroll-like volumes, but there were others which resembled somewhat our own bound volumes. I was told that this library was kept mostly for research and for historical reasons, as comparatively little reading or writing is done in our usual manner. Most records are kept in memory machines or some other unfamiliar electronic device. The alphabet consists of a number of cryptograms. I did not linger long enough, however, to go into things of this nature in detail. Another thing that did impress me was the wide variety of pictures and objects of art which were everywhere. These people are exceedingly artistic, and almost everyone spends some time at his particular chosen expression decorating screens, ceramics, furniture, etc. All were given some treatment whenever opportunity presented. It was all in very good taste, however, and most pleasing to the eye. These traits are quite evident in our modern Chinese. Going through several of these offices, we again emerged into the open air. Before us was one of the larger radial streets. Coming down this street was what looked like a silver gondola of some sort, suspended from an overhead rail. Going closer to examine this strange craft, I found that it was about 20 feet long. It had 6 or 8 bucket-like seats. There is a rather elaborate system of control used. All is done, of course, electronically. There is an eye on each end to keep it spaced a reasonable distance from other cars. Gyroscopes are used to prevent sway, and it is powered by a motor in each flanged wheel which rides a single rail, suspended at short intervals by metal standards. These cars are stopped with a single blast of a noiseless supersonic whistle and started after the passengers sit down. A number of the main radial streets have this monorail shuttle car system. Others used moving sidewalks, somewhat similar to escalators. Inside the tubes, which are the Martian cities, are these little shuttle cars, used for transportation. Chapter 4, The Martian Society. At this point my inspection of these very interesting monorail cars was interrupted by what appeared to be a gay group of people going into one of the nearby homes. As they disappeared, laughing and chatting through the doorway, I turned and looked inquiringly at Nur El. He smiled as he informed me there was a marriage going on. He went on to explain that marriage is very sacred here, very rarely is there a separation or divorce. As children, couples are selected according to their mental quotient and their compatibility. Further work in preparation is done until the time when they are actually joined in marriage, usually around the age of 12 or 15, as compared to our years. These marriage ceremonies last for about 3 days. The first day is spent in the exchanging of gifts between the respective families. The second day is devoted to mind projection and various semi-secret preparations. The whole affair climaxes on the evening of the third day with a banquet. Sitting on opposite sides of a long low table, the close relatives of the bride and groom eat a silent meal, not glancing up or looking across the table during the entire time. This silence is broken by the two fathers, or in case of their absence, the mothers can substitute by the sharing of a cup made from the juices of certain fruits. After this, the cup is passed around and the whole thing ends up with several hours of merrymaking. Then a parade takes the newlyweds to their new home. But to return to the subject of transportation. It seems that these people do not travel much, as compared to our Earth people. There is, of course, considerable intercity travel over the monorail car system which I saw in the tube. There is, however, a kind of communication which renders a great deal of travel unnecessary. This is a form of telephone, or teleview as it could more properly be called. Besides conversing, each party can see the other one through a small screen similar to our television. This, of course, can be shut off by manipulating a button, in the event there is a need for privacy. Speaking of television, their system is far more advanced than ours. The screen is built into the wall of the room and is about 4 by 5 foot square. All programs are in three-dimensional color, very lifelike and natural. Such programs are, of course, the very highest type. As there is only one channel to a city, all program material is produced and telecast by the people themselves, since there is no advertising or sex intimations but only such things as the festivals, lectures, various stage presentations or musicals which take place in the central theater. Little or no news is broadcast, and then only that which is of a nature which would not cause fear or restlessness. Music plays an important part in life here. Most of the instruments are of the string type and are usually plucked. There are some reed or flute-like instruments which help give variety. There are none of the heavy percussive type which form a large part of our modern orchestras. The music itself is, for the most part, a quaint sing-song-like rhythm or chant which usually depicts some story or moral lesson, or even historical events are portrayed. Considerable color is used in the stage presentations, which gives much added charm as the innumerable color combinations rise and fall with the rhythm of the chant. Since my initial trip, I have returned to Mars several times and have learned much more about this fascinating civilization. To those who are proponents and ardent supporters of our free enterprise system, let it be said that they have a great shock coming to them. On Mars there is no dog-eat-dog competition such as we, on Earth, are so familiar with. Everyone works for the government because the government is the people. This highly developed socialistic system is not to be confused with any so-called communistic governments on Earth. The Martians never break laws, consequently there are no laws. They have long ago eliminated legislative bodies. How different here! We have a huge and vast intricate network of legislative bodies, as well as various branches of law enforcement. The average American has many thousands of laws to obey. The great majority of the people either knowingly or unknowingly are breaking laws. As fast as a way is found to circumvent one law, a new one is passed to prevent this. The modern Chinese have placed a great deal of personal value on face, they would rather die than lose face. This sense of personal integrity was brought down through the ages from their Martian ancestors. The average Martian has an advanced state of conscious personal integrity. This eliminates the ponderous and very expensive system of government to which we are accustomed. There is in consequence a vastly simplified way of life. There are no taxes, as this land is run like a highly ordered non-profit business. The various departmental or executive heads are all highly trained specialists and hold their positions because of ability and integrity. Another thing which some Earth people would miss on Mars is money. They actually use no money. Therefore there is no banking system. The citizen of Mars is, in a sense, his own bank and his medium of exchange is his honesty, his credit. Everyone works. There are no loafers or unemployed. They all take great pride in their vocation. Work is not done for personal gain or selfish reasons. There is on Mars no sense of insecurity, for all are provided for, including the aged and the incompetent. A working person is provided with a metal plate whereon are stamped his, or her, name and an identifying number. This plate is used in the large automat-like dispensers which I was shown on the lower floor level. When a person desires food, clothing, or whatever the need, he merely inserts this charge A plate, if I can call it such, and withdraws it, along with the article. As he is a very honest person, he never gets more than he needs or is entitled to. This is done strictly on his own personal sense of honor and integrity. As he has no sense of insecurity, he never hoards or takes more than he requires. We can imagine what would happen if our great hordes of dishonest, grasping, selfish people were turned loose in the Martian cities. There are none of the conveyor belt line techniques that we use here. Although they are very advanced in science, electronics, and machinery, yet there are a great many handmade products. They realize that a vast productive system would only defeat their way of life. The more a man works, the more he can take home, so if a machine takes his place, he has nothing. An article is valued only for its usefulness and not for the profit it might bring. There is some semi-private enterprise. In case a person makes some product in his spare time, he may open a booth where it is displayed. All such enterprises operate on a barter exchange system. As there are no profits, these private exchanges consequently are not running in competition with any other. I have gone to some length in trying to point out and explain what is very obviously a superior way of life. We Americans have for a long time prided ourselves as having the best way of life on Earth. This is quite true as far as Earth is concerned, but not in a broad unlimited view. As Einstein once said, we are never fools until we quit seeking. In our present democratic system, which is actually capitalistic, we have long passed the point of diminishing returns. A government should be of the people, and we should not lose this goal in our haste for profits. The average citizen of the Earth has a state of existence something like a whipped circus animal. Yes, it is quite true that we have a higher level of life than many other countries, but what a price we are paying for this. And couldn't we get something better if we tried? But back to our Martian friends. From childhood they are taught to be useful and productive. Because of their simplified living habits, they have more time for self-improvement and for developing new types of plastics, textiles, etc. They usually limit their meals to only two a day, and even those are very simple, consisting primarily of vegetables and fruits, with some synthetic foods. The Martians are not meat eaters, partly for the reason that animal life has largely passed from existence on Mars, with the exception of mutants and the few obscure species previously mentioned, and these are inedible. The Martian has learned how to grow, and also to synthesize many spices and to produce artificially, many protein foods. Many nuts, some of which look somewhat like peanuts, are raised. A large nut similar to a pecan is grown on vines. There is a vegetable something like a cross between cabbage and lettuce, the leaves being 3/4 of an inch thick and about a foot wide. It is light green in color and very nourishing. Another common vegetable looks like our onion, but has large, flat, flared leaves. The people produce artificial sunlight in huge tubes so they can grow foods in their underground cities. Space is not too plentiful. There are some dwarf trees, 3 to 4 feet high, with a fruit that looks like an orange but has meat like that of an apple, is red-skinned and sweet. It is called sityu. Some other vegetables are grown in troughs in long rows. These look like huge mushrooms and have a delicious meat. Chapter 5, Science and Philosophy. The Harmony of Martian Life. Martians are closely connected with the Venusians through thought transference or mental telepathy. At one time, interplanetary travel was used, but these spacecraft are at present stored in huge underground hangars, and are being held in readiness for any emergency, such as a sudden mass evacuation of the population should any unexpected need arise. Yuzak explained that the science of interplanetary travel was something very difficult for the Earthman to understand, inasmuch as the people and the craft itself would, in taking off, actually change the rate of vibration of their own and the craft's atomic structure. Thus they would in a sense become weightless and temporarily free of various usual forces such as gravitation, inertia, etc. This is something like the preconditioning for fire walking, which is still practiced in different parts of the globe. My guide went on to explain that this science of changing the atomic vibration rates is a very advanced one, and that if the Earthmen would learn this, it would remove all the present-day obstructions and barriers such as materials, fuel, pressures, and the hundreds of other hindrances to present-day space travel. At present their experiments have progressed to a point where a man's body can be changed into electrical energies, sent over a radar beam and then changed back to the original state, all in a matter of a split second, and with no pain or discomfort to the individual. This no doubt sounds fantastic, but remember that this same thing is being done here frequently, from the spirit side of life. The memoirs of Sir William Crookes give an example of this in his experience with Katie, who materialized after being dead for several years. She was so real that he embraced and kissed her. Afterward he said she was as real as his living wife. Nowadays it is only the ignorant man who scoffs at any new ideas, and no doubt there will be those who will be unable to believe these truths, but it does not matter, since that still does not alter the facts. Just 50 years ago they were laughing at the Wright brothers, and think of what has been invented and improved and brought into use since that time. No less so in the future. The things of science which are commonplace in the Martian way of life could well become a part of ours in some future day. I was informed that the Martians understand what is happening to the Earth people and its veritable rat race, and they are very desirous of aiding through mental telepathy to inspire as many of the Earthians as are receptive to their ways for the advancement of mankind and the improvement of conditions on this planet, and within man himself. Until man realizes the great overbalance on the material side and gains the necessary spiritual knowledge, we cannot hope to be harmonious with the other more advanced planets. They say that it is realized only too well that they must not interfere with the evolution or progress of man on Earth to any great extent, for it would not be in keeping with God's immutable law of individual soul progress. The scientists of Mars have informed me that our telescopes, in the photographing process, are subject to error and do not get refraction but infraction. Sometimes the light rays, or vibrations as they are more properly called, are at times subjected to distortions, or bendings, in their flight through space, due to the proximity of some other planetary body. Because of the conjunction of magnetic lines of force, the astronomer does not always get a true picture of what he thinks he is seeing. Also, the planet Mars, on the outside of its surface, has a tremendously charged shell. While it is invisible to the eye, this can cause great distortions in light ray frequencies. And so the time has come, at least for the present, to return to our more familiar planet Earth, and I do so reluctantly, for there are still many more facets of life on, rather in, Mars of which I have only a slight understanding. I would like to learn more of their various customs, celebrations, and observances. Obviously, it cannot all be taken in during only a few trips. I cannot recall a single instance of this most fascinating and interesting experience of my visits to Mars without a deep feeling of awe, reverence, and gratitude to this very fine person who calls himself Nur-El for giving so unselfishly of his time and efforts in explaining so many things about the planet, its people, manners, etc. But the most important part he is playing, along with many others on their planet, for all have this one thing in common: to present the plea for man to heed their warnings and put the use of atomic energy to constructive use, instead of in bombs. For through their ability of clairvoyance and mental telepathy, they can see what is happening, and are tremendously concerned regarding their own planets. For anyone who understands even the slightest degree regarding the fourth dimension, can't help but realize that the destruction caused by the explosions and other results on the physical plane are indeed a very small part of the upheaval which takes place in the higher realms of existence, and even on the other planets. When throwing a pebble into a pool, we can only see the ripples with the physical eyes, but still down, on and on, goes the stone regardless of whether we see it or not. The men on other planets are pleading for their own sake as well as ours for us to cease this nonsensical destructive thing that can only lead to tremendous repercussions in the ethers, even to a far greater degree than in the material or physical way. There is also a grave concern by these people about our destructive downhill way of life. We are creating and breeding a race of psychopathic misfits in our highly specialized, mechanical world. The people are becoming robots. They cannot sleep for nightmares from fear and insecurity. Their days are an endless succession of almost frantic scurrying, or worse, a robot-like existence of work, sleep, and work. On every hand, flagrant psychological and sexual stimulants are used for advertisements. Suggestion is used to hammer home these cheap and malicious messages until the brain becomes numb and neurotic. Exploitation of the masses has become a highly specialized science, ruthless and cold-blooded, running the gamut from charity to vice. On the other hand, there are almost equally frantic attempts being made by various religious groups, churches, individuals, etc., to portray in some way to the great masses the grave dangers confronting them. These efforts are pitifully small and weak. Moreover, these efforts are not above suspicion, for there are, here as elsewhere, many charlatans. Chapter 6, The Supernova Connection. Resolving all these facts, and in trying to establish and correlate an active, vital, spiritual concept in their hearts and minds, Earthlings must find their own solution. Quite likely, in some future day, man will evolve a way of life that will embody not only some of the old spiritual and psychological factors which have been tried and tested, but many new and advanced facts will be added, new at least as far as the majority of the people are concerned. In this spiritually and scientifically integrated philosophy of life, man will find not only surcease from this present day's mad race to oblivion, but will find instead a new concept of the continuity of life, and with a Garden of Eden life will come happiness, creativeness, and fearlessness. It was intimated in the foregoing pages that it was quite obvious that it would require several trips to gain a comprehensive understanding of the Martian way of life, and that therefore, I would quite likely, from time to time, make similar visits or flights. Since concluding the last pages, Nur-El has made contact several times and has given or shown me pertinent information regarding several issues which I would like to clear up. In case some of you are wondering, just as I did, what caused his people to go underground and why they do not migrate to some other planet since they have all the necessary craft to do so. Nur-El explained all this by first saying that Mars was, Up until about 100,000 years ago, a planet very similar to the Earth. There was air, water, and an abundance of plant and animal life. The cities flourished on the surface just as ours do. At that time, through their occult science and also with their superior telescopes, they saw, somewhere out in space, a cataclysm take place. One of the giant suns suddenly went berserk, flared up like a nova, and then exploded in a terrific blinding flash. Huge chunks hurtled out into space in different directions, each one a smaller, white-hot, atomically burning sun, shooting off great streamers of atomic energies. It was determined by calculations that one of these fiery pieces would pass very close to our solar system. As it was larger than our own sun, it was conceivable that there would be tremendous repercussions. In fact, anything was possible. Because of its great size, it would have a tremendous gravitational pull, besides giving off great energies. It was also determined, as light traveled much faster in space than this huge chunk, that it would pass our solar system. This therefore gave the Martians a grace period for preparation. They had, however, a choice: to stay on Mars or to migrate to another planet far away from this solar system. After a search of the nearby, practical limits of the heavens, it was found that there was no other planet available which would be suitable. So an alternative was decided upon. They could build huge cities underground. During the next 200 years or so, an almost frantic building program was assiduously pursued. We can well imagine some of the problems, the sacrifices, and the labor and research which went into this tremendous project, but it was finally accomplished. In due time, all was snug and shipshape as possible. Buried deep under many feet of rock and earth, in their newly constructed dome-like cities, the people of Mars waited for the final hours. Day by day they watched the white glowing mass of light grow larger and larger. There was no really accurate way by which to measure how close it would pass or just how hot it would be. No doubt many thought it would be the end. Finally the hour struck. Ner-El stated that for 8 days the planet was rocked, torn, and twisted as great forces blasted and ripped the surface. Plant and animal life disappeared almost entirely, except for the few species which escaped by being buried or in caves. The air and water too, were largely dissipated or drawn off with the passing nova. When it was over, Mars was decimated and burned to a cinder. Other planets also suffered. On Earth there were great earthquakes and tidal waves. A great continent and civilization, called Lemuria, sank beneath the sea. Great deserts were burned into the surface in places which were formerly beautiful forests and plains. The Sahara and Gobi deserts were two of these. Earth's orbit and axis, or the poles, were also changed. Instead of a circular orbit, Earth was rocked into an elliptical orbit, with the addition of a very slight but definite wobble or oscillation, which it has never lost. Uranus was pushed out into an orbit much further away from the Sun. Neptune suffered a similar fate, although not quite so pronounced. It is conceivable that the other planets were also affected according to their size and position at the time of the passing of this huge celestial atom bomb. No doubt the knowledge of this cataclysm will clear up some of the mysteries of Earth's history which have been puzzling the seekers of truth for many years. Another question might be asked in regard to the Martian system of time. As nearly as can be determined, they maintain a daylight and dark cycle of days just as we do. This is done by simply dimming the overhead dome lights at regular intervals. A week is about 12 days. There are apparently no months tabulated, but the year is divided into four quarters, something like seasons. Their sense of time is quite different from ours. They practice none of the hurry-scurry which is so prevalent here. Thus there is no constant clock watching, or the tensions which such a practice produces. Here again is a similarity to the Chinese, i.e., there is always tomorrow, a familiar Chinese adage. Not that it should be construed that they are a lazy or indolent race, far from it. They are very industrious, but mark each day by their accomplishments and not with the passing of hours. Just in the event that there may be individuals who may take personal resentment, or a wrong view of any comparisons which have been made as to forms of government, etc., for the record let it be said, I consider myself just as much a loyal, staunch American as any other citizen. My parents and grandparents were all pioneers and helped carve out of a wilderness what is now known as the state of Utah. Moreover, my views on present-day political systems are comparatively average. As a philosopher and scientist, however, I might point out, as others have, many obvious flaws which are a matter of present-day concern. It is the task of our legislative bodies to anticipate and to circumvent such flaws. The Constitution is, in its entirety, a very wonderful document which expresses very highly evolved concepts of living. Such documents and governments resulting from them are, however, effective to the relative degree in which the so-governed people integrate them. The end result therefore devolves upon each individual so participating. The fact that there are 21 amendments proves the correctness of this reasoning. We must always remember that at no time in life should we ever assume we have reached perfection. We must always visualize an infinite universe in which perfection is only relative. We must not become restless or dissatisfied with what we have. Rather, let us be thankful to our Creator for each daily manifestation of His love and abundance, always secure in the knowledge that He will always so manifest. Our forefathers and those who helped carve out this great nation had such idealism and faith. Because we have countless conveniences which they knew not, we must not lose our initiative to keep pushing back the frontiers of ignorance, fear, and insecurity. Our present civilization, good as it is in some respects, leaves much to be desired. It has been the purpose of Nur-El, the people of Mars, and myself to bring you some understanding of their ways of life, hoping thus to bring about, not only among the nations of the world, but future interplanetary relationships which are harmonious and conducive to a better way of life. We all salute you and wish you infinite love, wisdom, and peace. Appendix. Shortly after writing this article, there appeared in the Saturday Review, on May 28, 1955, an article written by Dr. Robert S. Richardson, astronomer at Mount Palomar, which refers to the findings of the International Committee on Mars, which closed its fourth conference on March 25, 1955. There are several interesting statements made, on which I will comment. Mr. Richardson states the consensus of opinion is that there is life on Mars, or that it could exist. This is at least some progress in the right direction. Also, he is quite correct about the deserts. Most of the surface of this planet is semi-arid wastelands. It is, however, incorrect to say there is no oxygen there. The presence of the green maria, which he calls sponge-like algae, proves the presence of oxygen, although in a comparatively rare state. As everyone knows, oxygen is necessary in the breathing cycle of any plant which contains chlorophyll. Oxygen on Mars is about 10% of the density of the Earth's oxygen, as was stated in the aforementioned article. This sponge-like algae is found growing along the edges of the snow banks and often attains a height of 40 to 50 feet. It dries up with the vanishing of the snow caps and regrows the following spring. What the doctor states regarding water on Mars is very true. It is very scarce, and the people of the underground cities take great pains to conserve every gallon of it. As to the temperatures, that is still a matter of conjecture. It is a very tricky business to measure heat over 35 millions of miles distance. Moreover, surface temperatures do not affect the inhabitants of the underground cities, as they are completely pressurized and air-conditioned with temperatures maintained at a comfortable level. The most surprising part of the entire article was that there was absolutely no mention of the famous canals of Mars. I wonder what happened to them? These canals were for many years a great controversial subject. The photograph in this article does not show them, but this is perhaps explained by the fact that this photo was taken with infrared light film. It may be that the savants at MT Palomar would like to explain this. It is of questionable value that the writer interjected such a material angle as real estate. It seems it would have been wise to confine the remarks within the domain of science and leave this problem up to some of our great promoters in that future day of landing. It might also be that the Martians would resent our tearing up their planet. It is also probable that in that future day when man does have space travel to Mars, he will be able to take his wife or loved ones along. Landing there will be somewhat like taking a plane to a far-off city on this planet. On arriving on Mars, the spaceship will be taxied into a huge airlock. The passengers will disembark and find hotels and accommodations in a similar fashion as on Earth. Assuming, of course, that such factors as freedom from germ life, health, adaptability to lower air pressures, etc., have been fully compensated for. It is unfortunate indeed that the astronomers of today take such a dim view of the possibility of life on other planets. They should be in a position to know better than anyone else. Does it not seem a bit preposterous to assume that in all the countless billions of suns, star clusters, galaxies, etc., and their associated planetary systems, that Earth and Mars alone are inhabited? Perhaps we should refer to Jesus of Nazareth when he stated that, "In my Father's house are many mansions." In that distant day when space travel is a reality, let us hope that our men of science are universally schooled in the knowledge of the infinite God, and that we will find in this wisdom an integrated philosophy of life, one which will supply our need and an answer to every problem. In that future day, we will have put aside all our petty quibbling over interpretations. We will find God not only in the heart and mind of man, but in everything in this material universe.